It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, an outbreak of Ebola in Western Africa 5 years ago killed more than 11,000 people and threatened to become a global pandemic. We'll look back at the response to that outbreak and see if health agencies around the world are better prepared to deal with deadly viruses today. First, August and September's massive flooding around Wisconsin caused more than $37 million of damage. That's according to an assessment from FEMA, which toured the state last week. And Governor Walker has sent a letter to the White House to ask for federal assistance as Wisconsin counties recover from the onslaught of rain. Our next guest is here to talk about the damage and recovery efforts. Andrew Beckett is a public information officer with Wisconsin Emergency Management. Andrew, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be here, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, Andrew, we all remember those floods like they were yesterday. It wasn't that long ago, and we're looking at more rain now. But round up for us the kinds of damage we saw around Wisconsin.
Oh, we've seen a great amount of damage to roads, especially. Many highways, county level and state as well, saw some damage with, you know, washed out culverts, shoulders that received damage, pavement that buckled in areas especially that saw flash flooding, and a lot of homes where had significant amount of water in their basements, and some that even had water on the first floor of their homes as they were buried under the water from rivers that rose out of their banks. So it's an extensive amount of damage that covers a pretty wide area across the southern and central parts of the state. It also had a series of tornadoes and high wind events in late August that caused damage from trees being down, falling on buildings as well. So quite a variety of damage, quite a bit that FEMA looked at when it was here in the state last week, and quite a bit that many communities are still working to recover from at this time.
Right. Long term, a lot of this is going to take a while to bounce back from. But for the short term, critical stuff, how are we doing around the state as far as the immediate damage and getting things back to normal?
Well, many of the homes, private homeowners, are still working to recover right now. I was out with FEMA teams when they were in the state last week, and we saw a lot of contractors working on properties as they're still trying to remove some of the debris from homes that flooded, working to replace drywall that was damaged or to dry out areas, and replace appliances that received damage as well. Likewise, we've also got ongoing work on some of the roads that were damaged. Some of those routes are still closed, but some of them as well have moved forward with doing repairs when funding is available at this time, in order to make sure that those major routes get reopened. Most notably would be Highway 14 in western Dane County towards the Black Earth area, making sure that that major route gets opened again as soon as possible.
Now, this damage was dramatic, and now this request for federal help, there's a process here. Can you talk about what Governor Walker has written to the federal government about what that might get rolling now?
Sure. The governor's request comes after FEMA teams and the Small Business Administration were in the state last week, and they traveled around with state officials and local officials as well to view damage in many of the communities that reported damage from flooding. So they went to homes, they went and checked public infrastructure, they went to go and verify some of the numbers that have been reported. You know, we pushed very hard for people to report information to 211. That was part of the reason that FEMA was here, is in order to make sure that those numbers were accurate and to verify them and see them themselves so that the state could kind of craft this final report, this final letter to the president, laying out the case for why Wisconsin should receive federal aid. Now, that letter has been sent to the White House, which will review that information and determine what type of aid the state may qualify for and whether to grant the request for a federal disaster declaration. The state is seeking both public assistance, which is to help provide funding in order to repair some of the public infrastructure, the damage that was done, as well as individual assistance in many counties, which could be something like grants for homeowners who need to replace appliances or repair other damage to their home that was done by flooding or the other storm damage.
On that public assistance side of things, is this one of those cases where this would overwhelm, say, a county budget or local government's budget, the damage that's been done this summer?
You can see even the cost of debris removal can be quite expensive when you have areas that had standing water for sometimes weeks at a time. You know, you have a lot of debris from fields or trash that wash into an area. Getting that stuff out of there can be quite expensive, and it's an unexpected expense for many communities. So, yes, it's important to try and find additional funding in order to make sure that it doesn't strain local budgets too much.
Talking to Andrew Beckett from Wisconsin Emergency Management about flood recovery efforts here in Wisconsin. Andrew, is there a timeline on a request like this? Will we know when and if the federal government approves these funds?
We will know when they do, but in terms of a specific timeline, it's really hard to say. The federal government will review this, and they will let the state give the state an answer as soon as possible. Obviously, FEMA has a lot of other things they're looking at as well right now, especially with Hurricane Florence, but it's difficult to tell what impact that could have on getting an answer to the state as soon as possible.
Now, part of emergency management's job is to help recover from the last disaster. Have we learned lessons from this round of floods that might help us next time this comes around?
We learn lessons from every disaster. We find ways to do things better. We always take a look and examine our practices in order to make sure that we're doing things as effectively as possible, in order to make sure that the people of the state are safe and that they're able to get on the road to recovery as quickly as possible. You know, mitigation is an important task that takes place in the wake of a disaster. And Governor Walker talked about that many times while he was on the road visiting communities during late August and early September. The fact that, you know, we learned lessons from flooding in 2008 that helped to reduce a large amount of the damage that could have been done with this flooding. You look at a community like Gays Mills, which saw a significant amount of flooding this year, but also saw a great amount of flooding in 2008. As a result of mitigation efforts that were done in that area, you saw a lot less damage to private property because many of those individuals moved. They moved out of those areas that were prone to the potential of massive, devastating flooding.
Now, the flooding danger isn't over. A lot of lakes and rivers are high. We've already seen one community just in the last week or so have to shut down schools, close a bridge because I think it was the Pecatonica River. There are flash flood warnings in effect now as more rain is coming. What are you watching for in the days and weeks to come?
We're always keeping a close eye on water. You know, it takes time for that water to move its way through the different watersheds that exist in the state. And there is a constant concern about any heavy rainfall event and what it could have in terms of flash flooding on communities. You know, an important lesson for anybody to learn, especially from the flooding we've seen here in the past month and a half, is the fact that water can rise very quickly. And it can be very dangerous on roadways. Turn around, don't drown. You know, if you approach standing water in an area, don't go into it. Stop your car, back it up, find a different route, because you have no idea of knowing what conditions may exist beneath the surface. It's something we saw quite frequently with flooding in late August, was the fact that you had entire roads disappear underneath water as it moved across those roadways. The pavement was pretty much destroyed, and if somebody had tried to drive through there, not only would they have run the risk of their car getting stuck, it could have easily been washed off the road by fast-moving water. You know, it only takes about a foot of water to sweep a car off a road. So, you know, as we see the potential for more heavy rainfall going into the evening and overnight hours tonight, it's very important that people take that lesson to heart.
And another lesson you mentioned, calling 211 during the flooding in August and September to report damage. Is that a general rule?
In general, with each incident, there will be guidance from local officials in terms of how they want you to report damage. 211 is utilized when we have incidents like this because you have a large volume of calls, and local officials are working very hard to deal with multiple incidents at the same time. I mean, when you have widespread flooding in your area, it's very difficult for local emergency management staff to both take care of the response itself, but also collect that information. So in that case, we utilize a system like 211 in order to kind of take that strain off and have a dedicated hotline. So really, it's one of those things where each individual situation will kind of dictate how local communities want their residents to report that damage.
Andrew, I'll let you get back to watching the weather forecast for tonight. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Andrew Beckett is a public information officer with Wisconsin Emergency Management. He joined us today to talk about FEMA's $37 million damage estimate following massive flooding in August and September. Right now, an outbreak of the deadly virus Ebola in the Democratic Republic of Congo has infected at least 130 people. The World Health Organization has declared a very high risk of the virus spreading to other countries. This comes after an Ebola outbreak that started in 2013 killed more than 11,000 people in the West African countries of Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. Our next guest found that while the outbreak led to assistance from health agencies around the world, it also exposed some major flaws in how the world prepares for and responds to deadly diseases. Reed Wilson is a national correspondent at The Hill and the author of the book Epidemic, Ebola, and the Global Scramble to Prevent the Next Killer Outbreak. Reed, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
Well, you write at the outset of the book, there were a lot of heroes and great stories of people doing things both in the affected area, from around Africa, and from around the world. But if I'm reading your book right, your main message is this is a wake-up call. A lot of things didn't go the way they should have in the response.
Yeah, I think that's the right way to look at this. Ebola is an incredibly deadly disease. It kills more than half of the people who get it, depending on what strain we're talking about. But it's not that difficult to, or it's not that easy to get, to transmit between person to person. You actually have to touch, you know, blood or guts or something like that to get it from one person to another. What happens when the next virus comes along, one that's much more easily transmissible by air, if somebody coughs or sneezes or something like that? That's when the world is really going to face a true pandemic. And that's what public health officials are really worried about. We saw with the Ebola outbreak that the global public health system is not yet ready to handle and crack down on some of the big epidemics that could spread around the world.
So in the face of this spread of Ebola, what went wrong maybe in the earliest days of the spread of the illness that kept it from being contained until this was kind of a worst case in some way, until it went into a few really big cities in Western Africa?
Right. So one of the first things that went wrong is people didn't really know what they were looking at. Ebola is endemic to the Congo River Basin. Right now there's an outbreak, as you mentioned, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. It's popped up in the Republic of the Congo, in Uganda, in places like that, in Central Africa. These West African nations had never seen anything like it. And it's as if the difference between Central Africa and Western Africa is the difference between Seattle and Miami. I mean, they're a continent apart, and the communication is not the same as it is here in the United States. So people didn't know what they were looking at to begin with, which helped the spread. The second was the three countries that were affected are the poorest in the world. The GDP of Liberia is about 1% of what the GDP is here in the United States, or the per capita, that is. So, you know, instead of living on an average of about $50,000 a year, imagine if you were living on $500 a year. That poverty helps the disease spread as well, both throughout the rural regions and in the very slum-heavy major cities. And this was also the first time that Ebola came to a place where air travel is possible to major cities around the world. You know, there are direct flights from the capitals of all three countries to Europe and to the Middle East and to the largest cities in Africa. You know, we live in a globalized world now, a place where any bug is just an airline connection or two away from New York or Beijing or any other major city in the world.
The World Health Organization is an organization that people would turn to in hopes that they could thwart a disease like this once it becomes known. They get a lot of criticism for kind of a slow bureaucracy, a slow response. Can you talk about what they did in the Ebola epidemic?
So to begin with, the World Health Organization mobilized a few teams to go look at what this virus was that was raging in the rural hills of Guinea. And they thought they were looking at maybe a cholera outbreak or, again, I mean, they didn't expect Ebola because nobody had ever seen Ebola in this particular area. The World Health Organization eventually raced a number of authorities into Guinea, Liberia, and eventually Sierra Leone, but only after months and months in which the virus ended up growing. One big stigma in all this is that the World Health Organization started out by telling everybody in West Africa that if you got Ebola, you would die. Ebola will kill you. Well, that's not the message they really wanted to send. What they wanted to say was, if you get Ebola, you have to get treatment, and then maybe you have the opportunity to survive. The initial messaging of if you get Ebola, you're going to die meant that anybody who came down with the disease was more likely to hide from the World Health Authorities than cooperate with them and go to an Ebola treatment unit, because who wants to die in a sterilized space, you know, far away from your family? But as the way Ebola works is that as somebody gets sicker and sicker, they are more infectious to other people around them. So as your family is caring for you, if you've got sick, they are then more likely to get infected as the days go on. And as the, if when burial practices have to take place, and this is a culture where burial, it means a lot, where the traditions of dressing and preparing your loved ones for the afterlife is hugely important. and therefore about 70% of the cases were transmitted during the burial and funeral process. So the World Health Organization started out by warning people about how deadly this virus was instead of telling them how important it was to get treatment. Once they figured out that mistake, they both told people to get treatment, and they taught people how to safely bury their dead, which was a hugely important aspect of this. One of the things that I found most interesting in the course of researching this was that you know, the hard sciences helped come up with a cure, with a vaccine for the Ebola virus, but it was really the soft sciences, things like anthropology and actually understanding the culture with which you're interacting, that probably saved even more lives.
Talking to Reed Wilson, author of Epidemic, Ebola, and the Global Scramble to Prevent the Next Killer Outbreak. That reminds me of a common theme from your book, for authorities. They want to take decisive action. They want to be seen as taking decisive action. They don't want to do things that cause people to panic or behave in ways that are going to make things worse. And this is true in West Africa, in the United States, when there was a case spotted in Texas. Can you talk about how to thread that needle?
Yeah, and this, I think, comes a lot from who the president was at the time. I remember back before the last 2 years in which all of our hair has been on fire nonstop, we had, you know, President Obama was, his nickname was No Drama Obama. And he wanted to sort of convey the sense that the U.S. government had this, if Ebola came to the United States, it would be under control quickly. Well, that wasn't what people wanted to hear. They wanted to hear some urgency and some decisive action that would protect the country from what a lot of people thought was this threat. But let's not forget, in the summer of 2014, when Ebola was really blowing up in West Africa, there was also this group of madmen running across Iraq and Syria called the Islamic State that were taking over everything in sight. That was a pretty scary time in the United States. Go back and read the news clips, and everybody was pretty on edge. So the fact is, there's a dual side here to this coin of trying to make sure that people are calm and nobody's panicking, but at the same time showing the urgency and the action that a government needs to take to actually do something and contain a virus or a group of terrorists in the Middle East or something like that. There's a really delicate balance here that the Obama administration tried to strike. They got it wrong in the beginning, but I think in the end they did it right in that they sent, you know, the world's best organizational force, if you will, the U.S. Army, over to West Africa. 3,000 Americans went over to build Ebola treatment units. And, you know, of those 3,000, not a single one got sick.
I want to talk about early warning systems as we look at the future. You write in your epilogue, there are a lot of blind spots in the world where the public health authorities wouldn't detect a disease until it had started to spread. What could we do about that?
Yeah, so the Ebola supplemental bill, that's the bill that Congress passed to pay for the response to the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, it contained a provision that helped the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention pay for what were effectively mini Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in about 49 countries around the world. And I'm talking about countries like Congo and like, the three West African countries that we're talking about, Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone, and South Asian nations where a bird flu might emerge or something like that, South American nations where they're dealing with an outbreak of yellow fever in Brazil. And that's important because the global public health chain is only as strong as its weakest link. And there are a lot of really weak links out there. The United States, it has the best public health system in the world. We don't really experience outbreaks. The health as it exists in the United States isn't really the same concept as it is in sub-Saharan Africa or Southeast Asia, where, you know, death is unexplained, and death happens a lot more often than it does here at an earlier age and under circumstances that aren't always understood. So the fact is, we need these early warning systems around the world. We need somebody watching, whether it's a bird market in China, whether it's the slums of West Africa or of Rio de Janeiro. Something is going to come next. We don't know what it is. The World Health Organization has actually designated the unknown as a research priority. They call it Disease X, which is a nice and scary title that I think I might steal for my next book. But there is something else coming. We don't know what it is, but fewer and fewer people will die if we make sure that we're watching for it before it becomes a full-blooded pandemic.
In our last minute and a half or so, looking back at the reaction to Ebola then, do you feel like the world is more prepared now for disease X, whatever it might be?
The world is, in fact, more prepared, and that's because of really great organizations like the American Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The World Health Organization did a remarkable amount of self-examination to trying to figure out what they did wrong, and now they have a new directorate that is effectively for things like epidemic response, that is shipping hundreds of people into the Democratic Republic of the Congo right now. So we're getting better, but the fact is we're not there yet, and what comes next is not going to be Ebola. It's probably going to be a flu. It might be something that's easily transmissible by a cough or a sneeze. The fact is we have to be ready, not just in Central Africa, not just in West Africa, but in every part of the globe, because international borders don't get a lot of respect from a virus that can't see them.
Reed, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You got it. Thanks for having me.
That's Reed Wilson, national correspondent at The Hill. We've been talking about his book, Epidemic, Ebola, and the Global Scramble to Prevent the Next Killer Outbreak. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new report shows the State Department of Transportation knowingly overpaid for road work on Milwaukee Zoo Interchange in 2015. We'll find out more during our Wisconsin News Roundup. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with an ode to autumn.
Days are shorter, sweaters are thicker, and leaves are lusher. We are in the heart of fall. For some people, this is the ideal time of the year. And for others, like writer Chris Hardy, autumn is a bit more complicated.
I stopped the other day on a country road for a moment or two, a brief respite at the end of another busy day. Every day I drive by that point of rest. It's a barn no longer in use next to an abandoned farmhouse. The barn's not that old. The rounded roof appears to be in good shape, and the walls still have their faded red paint. Next to it is a small silo. There are many of these scenes dotting the countryside, buildings on smaller family farms no longer needed, where the economics of farming has ended their usefulness. They stand, silent and empty, eventually succumbing to the forces of nature. But on this late afternoon, I was beckoned to stop. The hillside behind the barn was a canvas of red, orange, yellow, brown, and green, illuminated by the sun and framed by a bright blue sky. The setting sun cast a shadow on the floor of the valley, and in a few minutes, the scene would be lost. I pulled off the road to capture this moment of pure autumn in Wisconsin. The timing may change slightly each year depending on the weather, but the palette of Mother Nature comes just the same. Daylight hours diminish. Photosynthesis in trees slows and stops. Deciduous leaves, dominated by green chlorophyll the rest of the year, show yellow, orange, and brown from carotenoid pigments and the reds from anthocyanins. The Wisconsin Department of Tourism tracks the changing colors across the state in its weekly color report. Leaf peepers travel around the state to take in an art show unrivaled by any museum. The show builds, climaxes, and then fades away in a drab final scene as the browns of late fall turn into winter. It's also harvest time. Farmers hope for an Indian summer, marked by sunny, dry, and warm days after a killing frost. It extends the small window to bring in the crops. On our farm, the corn harvest is underway. The beauty of fall is tinged with some sadness. The shortened days and cooler temperatures are our annual reminder that we're growing older. Work undone, words unsaid, regrets remembered. The English poet John Keats captured the melancholy of fall in his poem To Autumn, published in 1820. The last stanza says, "Where are the songs of spring? Aye, where are they? Think not of them. Thou hast thy music too. While barred clouds bloom the soft dying day and touch the stubble plains with rosy hue, then in a wayful choir the small gnats mourn among the river sallows borne aloft, or sinking as the light wind lives or dies, and full-grown lambs loud bleat from hilly bourn, Hedge crickets sing, and now with treble soft, the redbreast whistles from a garden croft, and gathering swallows twitter in the skies. It was one of Keats' last works, inspired by a walk he took near Winchester in September 1819. He died less than a year after the poem was published. Life is often as tenuous as the withering stem that holds a leaf to a branch. We know not if we're in the autumn of our lives or whether spring will come. She teases us, autumn does, with her fleeting beauty. "Take my hand," she whispers through the rustling leaves. So we do, and we dance amidst the blazing landscape, leaving our cares and worries behind, if only for a while. Inhale autumn's beauty. Be still. Thank your maker. Enjoy the dance.
Chris Hardy is a writer based in Jackson County. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up in just a little while on Central Time, we'll round up some of the top stories of the week in Wisconsin news, including the latest on a Department of Transportation story possibly overpaying for highway construction. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday. Everyone likes a good story, and our next guest believes that even the food you eat has an important backstory. When you think back about some of the foods you ate as a kid or while traveling or maybe meeting an important new person, they likely still mean something to you today because of the memories they hold. Chef Edward Lee spent 2 years traveling around the highways and byways of America, his mission to sample some great food and to gather the untold stories of small restaurateurs, immigrants, and small-town America. Edward Lee is the chef and owner of several restaurants in Louisville, Kentucky. He's been nominated for James Beard Award several times. You may have seen him appear on the PBS series The Mind of a Chef. His new book is Buttermilk Graffiti, A Chef's Journey to Discover America's New Melting Pot Cuisine. Edward, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what led you to set out on this road trip, finding the food, not the famous restaurants around the country, these places that most of us might overlook?
Well, so I am a big fan of the hole-in-the-wall restaurant, and I don't know, you know, if your listeners travel this way, but I always go to a new city and I'll do like a fancy meal one night, and then the next day I try and find that hole-in-the-wall place, that mom-and-pop restaurant, you know, some food truck, something that's really embedded in the community, and it's not always sort of written about or you can find online. And after, you know, years of doing that, I kind of came to this realization that, you know, we write so much about the celebrity chef-driven restaurants, and we write very little about the other side of restaurant cuisine, even though the food there can be just as good, if not better. And so I thought, it'd be interesting if I could do this journey, and my curiosity was there a story to tell? And I was pleasantly surprised by the fact that there were stories to tell.
Before we get to those stories, I got to ask, I would love to eat at those places when I go traveling. I don't know how to find them. How do you find that hole in the wall?
That's the beauty of it, is that, you know, in this day and age where we have the internet and all these lists and everything, a lot of these places are still hidden, you know, so you can't go the traditional way. A lot of it's just asking locals. For me, it's going someplace, you know, finding some locals that you trust and you think have good palate, you know, and then invest. It's like you kind of be like a little bit of an investigator. You really got to, you know, sniff it out. And every town has one. Every city has them, but you just got to put in the legwork. And sometimes, you know, like I've eaten in some bad places too, you know. Sometimes they're not always correct, but you got to be willing to strike out every once in a while too.
Now, there's a part two. You eat the food, but at least for this book, and I suspect you probably do this in general, you talk to the people cooking. You try to get their stories. What led you to want to do that too?
It's funny. a lot of times people think that the end of the journey is, you know, the finding the great meal, right? And eating that wonderful dish is like the pinnacle of the journey. And for me, it's just the beginning, because if I'm in a restaurant and I really enjoy the food, my curiosity goes nuts, you know, and I want to know more about the person behind the dish, or the culture behind the dish, or who's responsible, why is this here? And then, you know, my next curiosity sometimes is like, why don't more people know about this? Why isn't this place, like, you know, on every TV show? and so that to me is just like, it drives me. Yeah, listen, at the end of the day, if you love food, you have to love the people that make the food, right? So I'm just infinitely curious about the decisions people make, or especially a lot of the immigrant families that I talk to, and how they got here, and how they uphold these recipes, or how these recipes change because they got here. And I just, every story is so unique. And I really enjoyed sort of meeting these people along the way.
Yeah, that you find many immigrants along the way. Some of them at restaurants, some are home cooks too. Mm-hmm. What is it? And you see a lot of great American food being driven by immigrants in particular. What is it that's happening there?
Well, it's you know, it's the passion for preserving. You know, I think what happens with every immigrant group, and is the same with my parents, right? You come here. And then you get homesick, right? And so you can't go back to Turkey or Korea or Mexico or you know, Poland or wherever you come from. And so you use food as your nostalgia, right? Food is sort of your gateway to, like, you know, the homeland. It's the cheapest way, right, to sort of relive a memory. And for many immigrants, flying back home once a year or twice a year is not an option. So really it becomes about the food, and the food is not just about nutrition or nourishment. It's about, like, linking something to a former life, and that's very deep, you know. And so you just find these stories in the food, because through this food you're going to hear the stories of the homeland and how they got here and why they got here.
Can you share one of your favorite stories from one of those immigrant cooks?
Yeah, so one of the first chapters that I wrote, is one of the first chapters that I researched, was in Lowell, Massachusetts, and it's a pretty large Cambodian community. Actually, it's a very large Cambodian community that lives in Lowell, Massachusetts, and I'd known about this for a while, and so I went there and discovered this wonderful chef named Sam from Cambodia, and he. You know, did the typical immigrant experience, came, had a kid, put this kid through school, did many jobs, was a mechanic, you know, did all number of odd jobs to make way. And, you know, at the age of almost 50, he decided that he was going to pursue his passion, which was to open a restaurant and do sort of his Cambodian food. And you just don't, those, you hear a lot of those stories. They often don't end in success, right? Mm-hmm. You don't open a restaurant at 50 and most of the time it doesn't work out. And here was this guy, and I asked him, I said, where do these recipes come from? Because the food's delicious. And he said to me, it's just from what I remember eating when I was 12, because that was the last time that he was in Cambodia. So here's a guy, you know, and of course I immediately started to cry. But here was yeah. a guy who had suffered so much. It had been driven from his homeland when he was 12 and had never really lived in Cambodia as an adult. And then he's just trying to relive his childhood through his food. I mean, it's very powerful. And his food, I think when you have that much love and creativity for it, it shows in the food. So the food is delicious. Like, just first off, it's delicious food. And then it made me curious, and I hear the story behind it, and it actually makes the food taste that much better, knowing that story behind it. And I do think that when you understand the backstory of some of these chefs, and this is, it goes for any chef, whether it's a high-end chef or a mom-pop store, when you do take the time to know their story, understand their opinions, the food takes on a different perspective, and it actually, to me, it tastes better.
Talking to Chef Edward Lee about his new book, Buttermilk Graffiti, A Chef's Journey to Discover America's New Melting Pot Cuisine. Well, I don't want to leave Wisconsin out because you came here as part of your research and you were on the hunt for a solution to a mystery. Why don't we have really cool new German food in this country?
And one of your listeners has to give me an answer, or better yet, open a wonderful German restaurant, because the Wisconsin is you know, obviously, it's German, you know, it's a wonderful German culture that's still there, you know, and there are good restaurants. I don't want to be dismissive, but you know, my wife is of German heritage, and you know, we have a joke. We anytime we're in a traveling together in a city, if there's a German we Google it. If there's a German restaurant nearby, we always go. And they're usually terrible. Just the unfortunate part about it. Like, it is very, very, very hard to find good German food in America. And so I said, listen, we're going to get in a car. I've always wanted to do this. And we're going to go to the center of German culture in America and go to Milwaukee. And you know, we drove from Louisville, Kentucky. So we went through Indiana. So we stopped at a couple of places there. We went to Chicago. So just that whole journey, I mean, we must have eaten at easily a dozen German restaurants. And we just drove through the whole Milwaukee and west of Milwaukee, just in search of this. And you know, obviously it was a journey in search of German food, but it was also a very personal journey, for me and my wife. And you know, we talked a lot about her heritage and her culture and her, you know, and, you know, she's obviously American. Her family's been here for at least seven generations. But I think you still, you know, you still preserve some of that DNA inside you.
We inspired some recipes. It sounds like we've got a couple of them at our website, wpr.org/foodfriday. I'm really curious. A component in one of these recipes is a butternut squash sauerkraut. Tell us about that.
So, you know, I'm Korean by heritage, and Korean food has a huge, you know, pickling component to its cuisine. And obviously German food does too, which is also why I love German food. Like the pickling and the fermenting part of German food to me is so delicious. And we often think of sauerkraut as being cabbage, you know, which obviously is the most popular form. But you can pickle anything. And I know this because in Korea, we pickle anything and anything that moves. So, you know, when I was testing these recipes, it was fall. And we had just come from Wisconsin. It was winter in Wisconsin. I thought, you know, technically cabbage season was over. So what would you do if you didn't, you know, if you were 200 years ago and your farm had already harvested its cabbage? Well, you would pickle whatever you had. So I thought, oh, we should try it with butternut squash. And lo and behold, it was actually really delicious. And so I love doing, like applying techniques to ingredients that you normally wouldn't think to do. Like pickling squash, but it actually is really delicious. And it's something that you can do pretty easily.
Again, we have that recipe up at wpr.org/foodfriday. I wanted to ask you about another experience. You were in Dearborn, Michigan during Ramadan, and you decided, I want to try that breaking the fast in the evening like people would. Talk about what it was like not eating all day and then eating the food, drinking the drinks.
Well, if you're like me and you like to eat, not eating all day is pretty miserable. It was very hard, and I didn't know this at first, but you're not supposed to drink water either, so that was a whole other component. And actually, the first day that I did it, the thirst was so much more painful than the hunger, you know, the not being able to drink all day, and it was really it was an experience that I'm really glad I did. Because it was something that again, I'm not Muslim, and it's not, I don't know if it got me closer to the Muslim culture, but it was something being in that community and when everyone else was fasting, having that communal experience and having also them respect me because I was fasting with them, right? That I was here, you know, more or less as a journalist to write about food. And I thought it would just be impolite, if you will, for me to be gorging out on food and asking people all these questions while they're fasting. And so, and there's a story in the book, and you know, I wanted to be respectful and humble. And also I wanted to really understand culture from their point of view, not through my eyes, but through their eyes. And so I decided to fast, and I did it for about 3 days, which is not nearly, you know, as long as Ramadan is, but, It was really enlightening, and the funny thing was that at the end of the fast, when you break the fast, you know, I thought, oh my God, I'm gonna have, you know, 14 lamb chops and a bowl of hummus and all this rice, and in reality I was correct, and they said, no, you don't do that, you don't gorge yourself, you know, just to get through that. You're actually supposed to eat very humbly and eat very simple things and drink tea, It was amazing. It was amazing. Yeah, I looked better. I felt better. I lost a little weight. The hardest thing was actually coming, because then I thought, oh, you know, I had sort of done my field work, and I was coming back home, and I thought that I would continue to fast for the rest of Ramadan, and it was impossible. Like, so once I took myself outside of that context and outside of that culture, where it wasn't a shared experience anymore, and I was the only one doing it, it just became impossible. And it was fascinating to be put in that experience.
We'll leave it with that story. Edward, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Chef Edward Lee about his 2-year-long journey to learn more about food around America, the immigrants, many who make it, chefs, restaurateurs, maybe off the beaten path. He says, you take the time to find that hole-in-the-wall, out-of-the-way restaurant, talk to people there while you're eating, you might be very pleasantly surprised. His new book about that experience is called Buttermilk Graffiti, A Chef's Journey to Discover America's New Melting Pot Cuisine. Today is National Smile Day, created by the inventor of the smiley face logo, that little yellow fella you see everywhere. I found this on the Wisconsin State Journal website today. The smiley face dude was invented in 1963 by a designer named Harvey Ball. He was hired by a company after a big corporate merger that had led to some unrest among employees. His mission was to design a logo that would boost morale. He took 10 minutes and was paid $45, and the yellow smiley face was born. No evidence as to whether it actually helped with those employees or not. Now, he didn't copyright the happy face, and that led to some weird legal conflicts. Other people copyrighted similar designs and sold products with them. Then they sued one another over the rights to use it. Now, Harvey Ball, the original designer, just wanted people to be happy. So in 1999, he started World Smile Day to be observed on the first Friday in October, which brings us to today's World Smile Day. Now, he's since passed on, but according to the World Smile Day website, I'm quoting here, he thought that we, all of us, should devote one day each year to smiles and kind acts throughout the world. The smiley face knows no politics, no geography, and no religion. Harvey's idea was that for at least one day each year, neither should we. So, big smiles, everyone, to celebrate the smiley face and World Smile Day. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.